We started this case back in January in a snowstorm, and now we're in the middle of a heat wave. Your Honors, and perhaps Justice Holland, you could help me out here. Do you want us just to address the three questions that you put to us, or would you like us to address the...
No. When we have re-argument en banc, it's with regard to all issues. We haven't conferred about the case at all, so everything is before the court.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case involves a work accident of May 15th of 2007. My client, Eugene Watson, was employed at the Walmart warehouse, and he suffered an injury. He was out of work for quite some time and eventually was released to return to work. And at that point, he began a job search, and Walmart took it upon itself to file an application to terminate his total disability benefits. My client conducted a job search. He applied for 28 jobs, mostly on the computer, which I guess is now how much of that is done. He applied for some of the jobs which were on the labor market survey, which the employer had done. He applied to a few jobs in person. He was not called back on any of the jobs he applied to on the computer. Some of the jobs he applied to in person, the people just said there was no work available. He did tell all of the employers that he did have his certain work restrictions because of his back injury. Those work restrictions involved no heavy lifting. It was probably the most significant one. His job had been a blue-collar job, and the jobs he was searching for were blue-collar type jobs. The Industrial Accident Board held that he did not perform a sufficient job search, and that he was therefore terminated from his total disability. That case was appealed to the Superior Court, and the Superior Court upheld the decision, but did say that it felt that the court was wrong in its decision regarding the I'm drawing a blank on what their concern was, but in any event, they held that it was not a matter that was significant to a decision, and they upheld the Industrial Accident Board award.
Was it the causation?
I don't believe it was causation. I think it had more to do. Yes, it had to do with the employers. I believe the employers, not the inference.
Hiring him because he had those restrictions on his ability to work.
Right. The Keeley versus Metal Masters case from 1997, the Superior Court case, which held that if you don't get a call back, don't get hired, there's an inference that you weren't hired because of your disability. And that decision has never been addressed by this court, but the Superior Court case has been followed many times by the Industrial Accident Board and in other Superior Court decisions.
Is your concern here that there was error in allocating the burden of proof?
I'm not that concerned about the burden of proof because I think that does get it's a back and forth kind of burden of proof. I think my client is a prima facie displaced worker. He has limited education. His job skills are all blue collar. I think he's definitely a prima facie displaced worker. But in addition to that, I think he then conducted a reasonable job search and also found that the job market simply didn't want him with his disability. So, excuse me, Your Honor.
One of the aspects of the decision that seemed kind of stand out was the board's determination that it wasn't really a bona fide effort, that your client really didn't want to find a job, and he was just going through the motions, and therefore it's not a reasonable job search. And what I would like you to respond to is this. Let's assume that somebody in an excess of candor goes before the board and they ask, you know, what did you do for a job search? And the person explains, I contacted these 15 places. And then they say, well, were you really looking to get a job? Were you anxious to get back to work? And he says, No, I was just as happy that nobody wanted to hire me. Should that have any bearing on whether one has conducted a, quote, reasonable job search for purposes of the award?
The eight factors that the employer listed in their answering brief that are looked at, seven of them are objective, and I'll go over those if you'd like. But,
I'd like you to answer my question.
And I'm getting to that. The eighth one was the employee's motive. Is a factor that the Industrial Accident Board has looked at. And the case that was cited said that if you can clearly establish that the motive was poor, that that should be a factor. And I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think if an employee comes in and says, I really wasn't trying very hard because I'm getting this payment and it's two-thirds of my wage, and, boy, after you consider taxes, it's almost the same, and I just get to sit at home. I think the board should be able to consider that. That's not this case. My client did not say that.
Well, how would you summarize the legal error in this case that mandates reversal?
The legal error is that the Industrial Accident Board did not articulate why it felt that the job search wasn't reasonable. My client applied for 28 jobs. Now, the employer argues that almost half of those jobs were not within his restrictions. But that still leaves 14 to 16 jobs, which were. And the employer, the Industrial Accident Board did not explain why that's not reasonable.
So there was no standard that...
There was no standard.
All right, and did the Superior Court articulate a standard on review?
No, they did not articulate a standard either. They felt
you say like they, it was he, wasn't it? Superior Court?
Yes, yes. They did not articulate a standard either. And I think it would be beneficial to the Industrial Accident Board and employers and employees if there were some standards set by this court that you judge against. And then if you listed various aspects of a job search that should be considered, then you're not going to be able to get 100% of the cases right all the time, but that's the way our system works. But at least then the board says, okay, he applied for X number of jobs. He didn't hear back, or he didn't get hired. Now, in this case, a couple of the employers put in writing that they didn't hire him because of his restrictions, and I think that's a strong factor in this case.
What is the legal consequence of this statement by the board? Furthermore, the board accepts the testimony of Ms. Reno, who prepared a labor market survey that shows jobs for which claimant is physically and vocationally suited that are within claimant's restrictions and are available in the open labor market. What's the legal consequence of that finding?
The labor market survey indeed said that there are these jobs available. Some of those jobs were jobs that my client applied for and never heard back, so that the board didn't explain how you can say these jobs are available when my client applied for them and never got a return email or response from
the
employer.
They're addressing the jobs found by Ms. Reno.
Right, right. So, but my client applied for some of those same jobs and didn't hear back. And when he applied, he said, I'm subject to these restrictions.
Well, let me go at it a different way. Does the claimant get a list of the jobs that the professional person has determined are available and within his restrictions?
At some point in the process, the labor market survey is sent to the claimant's attorney.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is this. If the board is going to find it significant whether a labor market survey showed that there were these jobs available, and if it just happens to be by chance that your client would have actually applied for those same jobs because your client doesn't even have that list, maybe part of the problem is that if there's going to be some objective analysis here, the labor market survey has to be prepared, it has to be provided to the claimant, and then the claimant, it's up to him or her, but the claimant would be well advised to make an effort to apply to all of those jobs because supposedly those are jobs that are available to him. Is that a process that would be feasible?
Certainly would be feasible. Given the timing of the hearings, the labor market survey is oftentimes ordered around the same time that the employer files to terminate, and then you have a 4 to 6 month period between that and the actual hearing date. And my personal experience is that I usually get the labor market survey 60 to 90 days before the hearing date, although that's not a requirement, but that's usually when it does arrive.
Do you counsel your client to, you know, take a look at this list, and if there are places on here that you haven't already contacted, go ahead and contact them?
Absolutely.
Your client didn't do that.
He did contact many of those same places.
But not all of them.
Not all of them.
Let's assume that your client, this is a hypothetical, did contact all of them. And you get to the board hearing, and the employer says, well, here's my market survey of available jobs. And the employee says, I know. I got it 90 days ago. I applied to all of them. No one's gotten back to me or the other people who did turn me down. What does the board do?
I think that's a very significant factor, and the board should be instructed by this court to make that a significant factor.
Significant factor? Why isn't it a dispositive factor? I don't understand how this works. If the employer can come in and say there are all these jobs available, and you apply for all of those jobs, and you don't get any of them, how can the board say, well, there are jobs available?
I won't disagree with that. I think it was you who made the statement that what if the person said, I just don't want to work? Well, if they applied for all the jobs and at the hearing they also said, I don't want to work, I think the board should be allowed to consider that. But if the person has made an effort to get these jobs, has applied to all the jobs in the labor market survey, and no one's gotten back to them, I think, yes, their compensation should continue.
To restate Justice Holman's question, the hypothetical is that the employee applies for all the positions that are listed on the survey.
Right.
There is either no response from the putative employer, or maybe as here, a couple of them write back and say, we're not going to hire you. Why doesn't that dispositively establish that the search was reasonable?
I think it does.
All right.
I think it does.
And is there a causation issue at that point that we have to reach if we were to agree with that?
If you find that the job search was reasonable,
yes.
Is there another step you have to take?
Yes.
I don't think so.
In other words, is there an issue as to whether or not the failure of a reasonable job search was by reason of the employee's disability? Or is the inquiry end once the employee can show that nobody responded or offered to hire him or both?
I think the inquiry ends. I mean, it's generally, in this case anyway, there was an agreement on both sides as to what the limitations were. There was no dispute.
So the answer is there is no further inquiry.
Right.
But the ultimate issue here, isn't it, is whether or not your client is totally disabled.
Well, and as a displaced worker.
Which means he's totally disabled, right?
Given all the other factors this court has articulated, he's totally disabled.
Well, I mean, you're seeking a continuation of total disability
Correct.
Benefits, which can only continue if your client is totally disabled.
Correct.
And all of these tests and burden-shifting analyses are just means to an end.
Correct.
Which is the answer to that question.
Correct. I agree.
Now, here, did the board actually address the applications that your client made to the same employers that were in the labor market survey?
No, they didn't specifically address that.
Now, assuming that you are correct, that your client made a reasonable job search, that the burden shifted, and that ultimately the employer had to demonstrate that your client was not a displaced worker, or, in other words, was no longer totally disabled.
Right.
That analysis has not been done.
I can't say that it has been done. Well,
the board did say ultimately at the end, as with regard to the labor market survey, therefore the board finds that the survey and Ms. Reno's testimony are sufficient to prove that claimant is employable and not a displaced worker. Now, is that finding based on the evidence presented legal error?
Yes. I think it is.
Why?
Because I think his job search was reasonable, given the factors in this case. That's where the legal error is. I don't think the board...
Well, hypothetically, if that's accepted, it just shifts the burden, doesn't it? And the ultimate issue is whether your client's totally disabled.
The my initial argument to the board is my client's a displaced worker because of his education, background, experience, and his restrictions. Once I establish that, and I don't know that the board articulated whether I established that, the burden then shifts to the employer to say, yes, okay, you can say that, but there are jobs available, so we can rebut that presumption. And then my job, my client's job, is to do a reasonable job search to then rebut that presumption. And I'm not sure the board clearly articulated those different steps. But the ultimate answer is, if you get down to the job search, my client, I think, did a reasonable job search in this case, and that's where the legal error is.
But doesn't the statement that Justice Ridgely was just talking about from the IAB, doesn't that relate more to the prima facie displaced worker issue, or am I wrong about that, where the company is coming in and presenting their report saying, no, there are jobs available for this kind of a person? Doesn't that go to the first way to be a displaced worker, namely the prima facie case, as opposed to the making of reasonable efforts to secure employment and not getting it because of your injury?
Yes, I think that's what the labor market survey does.
Well, let me see if I understand the chronology in this process. Your client was totally disabled. Then he got a doctor's certificate that said you can go back to work as long as you don't lift more than 20 pounds.
Right.
So he technically was no longer totally disabled.
Correct.
He applied for all of these jobs that we know about, didn't get any of them, and contended, I'm a displaced worker, which in effect puts me back at total disability because I can't get a job.
Correct.
And then the employer wanted to come in and say, well, no, you're really not a displaced worker because all of these jobs are available. And then the legal issue we have is once we got to the debate of whether he was totally disabled because he was a displaced worker, did he conduct a reasonable job search, and is the board's conclusion that he did not supported by the record?
I don't think it is.
But
and they didn't articulate.
Is what I just outlined the analytical model that we have to go through?
That's my understanding of the current state of the law, yes.
Okay.
One factor that hasn't been raised here, and I think it's one of the most important ones, is that Walmart did not offer him a job. And I think that is objectively probably the most important factor when an employer the size of Walmart says, we don't have any job for you at all. And I think that, in this case, is very important.
Well, let me ask a question, because now I'm confused. If the employer offers the claimant a job, isn't that the end of it? Because, by definition, you're able to work because you could have taken this job. You didn't take the job, that's it.
Absolutely.
You know? Okay.
My client would have gone right back to work.
So there can be a lack of total disability, notwithstanding a reasonable job search. I mean, if Walmart at the end of the day at the hearing said, "Come on back," even if your client did everything reasonable in terms of applying, there would no longer be total disability.
Correct. or he wouldn't be displaced.
Because that's the ultimate issue here, isn't it?
Ultimately, yes. It's the right to get the full payment of your weekly wages, two-thirds of your weekly wages, because you're totally disabled.
Remind me, is your client getting paid throughout this appellate process?
No.
So he's getting paid for partial disability, but
right.
not total?
Correct. Right. I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Yes, you want to reserve that time?
Yes. Thank you.
Good morning again.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Christine O'Connor. I have the pleasure of appearing before you again on behalf of Walmart.
Can I start with what I asked opposing counsel?
Of course.
Does it matter, or should it matter, whether the claimant is gung-ho, looking for a new job, I really want to get up in the morning and go to work, or knows that he has to make a reasonable job search, he has to make an effort, but would be just as happy if it turns out that there aren't any jobs?
Yes, I think it should matter. The Superior Court in this case alluded to motive and the sincerity of the effort as being a major factor in the analysis. Now, the analysis, I know we don't have standards, and that's what's troubling the Court. But there are other cases, including the Miranda case that I cited, the Visnovsky case, where the courts have said over and over again, we will look to the depth of your efforts. In fact, the Bernier case, which was the seminal, one of the seminal cases that set forth the general standard of judging the reasonableness of a job search, said that the claimant has to make a good faith effort to locate employment within some suitability parameters.
Okay, but I guess my problem is that good faith and reasonable efforts and all those kinds of words could be applied to the process itself. You can't apply to one job, don't get it, and say, well, I tried, couldn't get work. But if you apply to 14 or 20 different places and don't get anything, how can one say that that was not a good faith effort?
I think it goes beyond personal motivation and the feeling one has as to whether or not they want to be employed. A good faith effort includes what types of jobs you're looking for, obviously the number of jobs. In fact, these courts in the state of Delaware have found situations where claimants search for upwards of 100 jobs, even jobs supplied by their attorneys, as being an unreasonable job search, believe it or not. So there are many factors that are encompassed in the good faith umbrella, so to speak.
Well, let's go back to the questions we asked Mr. Snyder, where, the employer comes in with a survey and says, this wasn't good faith because here are 20 jobs they could have gotten. And let's assume hypothetically the list is known 90 days ahead of time. The person applies for all 20 jobs. What's the significance when you get to the board hearing in that the employer says there are 20 jobs available, and the employee says, I applied for all 20, I didn't get any. What does the board do?
Well, I think the court needs to understand that the labor market survey process, the production of the final evidence that is introduced before the board, is in fact that, a process. We have reports that are produced throughout the pendency of a petition.
No, I understand the process as it exists. What I'm trying to understand is the apparent disconnect to reality. When you get to the board hearing and you say we've conducted a survey and there are 20 jobs available, this person didn't conduct a good faith effort because if they had, they would have applied for one of these 20 jobs and succeeded. That seems to be an academic argument if in fact, in reality, it never would have happened. So we're trying to develop some standards using this case as a vehicle, and that's my question. If we say that the market survey should be made known to the employee 90 days ahead of time, and the employee should apply for all of those jobs in a good faith effort, if the employee does that, gets no job, What should the significance be?
Well, it's hard to say because the jobs are identified over time. And in this case, Mr. Watson received the labor market survey and applied for jobs that were no longer available. The law in Delaware doesn't require an employer to affirmatively locate and secure a job for an injured worker. And on the injured worker side, they are not required to show actual employment to be entitled to partial. So to have such a strict rule involving the labor market survey in that if 20 jobs are identified and the claimant can't secure them for some reason, I think it's unreasonable to hold that against the employer and perhaps award the claimant with automatic total disability.
Let me ask a different hypothetical that combines the two that were raised by Justices Holland and Berger. It comes in two parts. Part number one, let's simplify the facts and assume that the survey, which has a list of available jobs, was produced on the date of the hearing, so it's absolutely current. Or I shouldn't say the date of the hearing, but maybe 2 weeks before, so that it's very contemporaneously close to the hearing. The employee applies for all of those jobs, doesn't get any response from anybody. What happens then? What does the board do? That's question number one. And then question number two, same facts, assume that at the hearing there's no testimony one way or the other as to whether the employee really wanted to get a job or he didn't. And in the alternative, there is testimony that the employee says, well, I really, I'm not all that enthusiastic, but the objective facts are the same. So the second question is, does his subjective state of mind matter?
The answer to the first part of your question is that the labor market survey is a hypothetical review of what is available in the job market, and the board understands that. The board looks at it as such. It is not concrete evidence of jobs that are available at that moment when the parties are in the hearing room. It is evidence that the employer...
So you changed my hypothetical. You're saying that because of the way the survey is produced, it can't, by its nature, be a survey or contain a list of real-world available jobs?
It does over time, but in the same vein, that the employee has the duty to be searching for work during that time.
So the employee can't rely on that?
I would say no, not 100%. It's used as a rebuttal tool for the employer when we have the argument that we have here. My client is economically totally disabled. That's the argument we have here.
Okay, so you're saying that a list of hypothetical jobs can defeat a claim that a reasonable search was made, even if the employee relies on that survey 100% and follows through 100%?
Arguably it can. The board is the fact finder. I know that they weigh a lot of things in the balance.
Well, let me make sure I understand this. Let's suppose the employer survey is 20 jobs, and the employee looked for 20 different jobs and was turned down. If I understood your answer to Justice Jacobs' question, you said the employee could actually look for 20 jobs that he was qualified for and apply for 20 jobs and get turned down for all 20 jobs, and that would be deemed to be an unreasonable job search because theoretically he could have gotten one of the employer's jobs on the employer's list.
No, I don't. If I stated that, I didn't mean to. Before the burden shifts to the employer, it's obviously focused on the reasonableness of that job search. If there is a search involves 20 jobs and he's turned down, the inquiry has to go further. Was it because of your injury? Was it because you didn't get a response like this case? It's very difficult. The labor market survey report comes in afterward to rebut the finding of a non-reasonable job search.
Well, does it also come in, and if the board had said, the burden has shifted here, it's now Walmart's burden, would you be relying on the labor market survey to prove your case?
That's exactly what we did, yes.
And did the board here
address the sufficiency of that labor market survey compared to the fact that the claimant applied for and did not get some of the very jobs that you're saying are available?
I believe they did. And when we present labor market survey evidence, we present evidence as current as possible. We don't say that all of the jobs are available at that moment when we're in that room. It is a survey over time during the pendency of the petition where the employer has taken the stand that we, in good faith, have filed this petition to terminate benefits.
Well, where in the board's opinion does it show that they actually addressed how many of them there were, where the claimant applied for the very same jobs that you're saying are available, and he didn't get them?
I don't think they specifically addressed that aspect. I think hearing testimony from an injured worker that they did, in fact, apply for jobs identified in the survey is one of the factors that weigh in the balance. It's one of many factors, and I tried to identify in my supplemental briefing 7 or 8 more. It's a totality of the circumstances almost analysis.
Well, the way you describe it, it sounds as if the claimant is dealing with a moving target. At the point at which the employer files the petition to terminate the total disability, the employee then is on notice that there's a prospect that I'm not going to continue to get these benefits, and the employee hopefully is advised by his attorney that, you know, you've got to make a good faith effort to find a job, but the employee is not given the employer's market survey, in part because it hasn't yet been developed, and in part because it doesn't matter what's on that survey, because even if he were given that survey and he couldn't find a job and he looked at all the places on the survey, the answer would be, well, you know, these surveys are moving in time, and, well, of course, something that was available 3 weeks ago may not be available today. And so the fact that we have this survey, even though it has not proven to come through as a factual matter, the fact that we have this survey is enough to counter his claim of a reasonable job search.
That's correct. And the survey is only being offered to show that, in fact, there is a loss of earning capacity. We conceded that at the beginning of the hearing, but that doesn't alleviate our burden to show what that loss of earning capacity is. Walmart's still on the hook for paying two-thirds of the difference between the pre-injury and post-injury earning capacity, wages versus earning capacity. The labor market survey is a tool. It is not a perfect tool. I don't think anybody expects an injured worker to, A, apply for all of the jobs. There's no rule that says they have to even apply for any of them. And I don't think it's going to be held against them if they walk in and said, hey, I gave it the college try and I can't find any of it. The board looks at the labor market survey as a tool for a separate part of the analysis.
But if the labor market survey is hypothetical, it is not factually accurate because these jobs no longer exist, or they only existed for one day and they were filled and, you know, he didn't get his application in on that one day, how can that labor market survey have the weight that it is given as being able to rebut evidence of a market search?
Because you have an expert that testifies that they specifically visit these employers. They see the jobs. They identify, hypothetically, an individual with certain restrictions, and they talk to these employers, you know, about would there be a job available that this person could apply for? Again, as the employer, we do not have the duty to secure actual employment. And on the other side, in protection of the claimant, they do not have a duty to show actual employment before they are entitled to partial.
All right,
there's a balance.
Is it correct that the bottom line of your argument is in effect, the law is telling the employee this market survey can be used against you, but you are not entitled to rely on it such that if you were to apply for all the jobs that are listed on there, that would conclusively establish that you made a reasonable job search?
I think it would be dangerous to have that as a...
Well, I mean, I think if the answer to that question isn't yes, then I don't understand anything that you've argued before us.
Could you ask the question again? I'm sorry.
All right. Right now, under the current law, the market survey, you know, which is a moving target, can be used against the employee. That is to rebut the reasonableness of the search. Correct?
Correct.
But at the same time, if your position is correct, the employee, even if he were to apply for all the jobs that are listed on the market survey, couldn't rely on that survey and on compliance with that survey to establish that there was a reasonable job search.
I think they can, and in this case he did. He argued that he applied for the jobs but just wasn't able to secure them. Understand, too, that the labor market survey also speaks to that second part of the reasonableness.
I don't think you either didn't understand what I asked you,
okay,
or I didn't understand what you just said. Let's assume there are 30 jobs that are listed in the survey.
Right.
Employee comes before the IAB and says, you know, I have the survey. I applied in timely fashion for all 30 jobs. I didn't hear back from anybody. Why shouldn't the IAB, on that basis, be able to rule without any further evidence that a reasonable job search had been performed?
I think you have to take the time factor and the evolution of the vocational expert search into consideration, just as we have to take the claimant's job search and how it evolves over time.
We've already talked about the job search. I mean, either the claimant is entitled to rely on the jobs that are listed in the survey or he's not. Which is it?
I don't think the labor market survey report ever was intended to be...
Right, let me, I apologize for interrupting, but I think the jobs that are being identified are categories of jobs, or are they a type of a job? It's not, as opposed to a specific, there's a job at XYZ company in this particular, you know, doing whatever.
What it is a...
But which is it of those two, or maybe it's some combination?
It's both. We usually identify through our vocational experts jobs that are in keeping with the physical restrictions, i.e. sedentary duty, light duty, medium duty. And then the reports that the employer offers will identify specific jobs from specific employers that have openings as the labor market survey progresses. It is an ongoing search. And it's just to establish that, given your restrictions, Mr. Watson, and understanding you can't go back to your original job and make X number of dollars, this hypothetical report, that this process that has been accepted by the board for forever, shows that you have a loss of earning capacity because of your injury. That is all we have to show, and it helps establish the monetary rate that the claimant is entitled to. It's not set in stone. It evolves, and I think to have that as the report itself be the one determining factor as to whether or not someone is economically totally disabled changes our entire system altogether.
All right. Well, that's helpful, at least to me, in understanding part of, I think, what's going on here. And what you're saying is Walmart didn't want to pay him total disability, but acknowledging that there were jobs available, and they were willing to pay him for his reduced capability.
That is
just
absolutely
not total.
Correct.
So then we're back to, should he get total? And as I understand the employer's argument here, it is you should not continue to get total disability because hypothetically jobs were available, and even if they're not available now, theoretically you could have gotten a job, and even though it's no longer available, you don't get total disability.
That is correct. That is what we are entitled to as the employer, to rebut the evidence from the claimant.
So my question to you, going back to my reality concern, is that fair to say you're no longer going to get total disability because you didn't get a job that's not even available now?
No, because the employee does not have to get a job. They don't have to walk into the board and say, I got this job, I'm making $7 an hour versus 10, and therefore I'm entitled to the difference, or I didn't get a job. It's just the employee does not have to secure a job in order to be entitled to that inference that Judge Young referenced in his decision. Where the board missed the mark in this case is they failed to recognize that the employee, because he testified that he disclosed his restrictions to all of the employers, the 28 employers he either applied to or talked to, the board missed that. Maybe Mr. Watson should have been given that inference, that he was not hired because of his restrictions. Now, there are a host of problems with that, as we addressed in the last argument. But my argument now is that we don't even get to that part of the analysis because the board found that the job search was not reasonable. Again, recall, Mr. Watson...
But again, isn't it the fact that the board found his job search was unreasonable because of the fact that there was an expert who presented a labor market survey who showed that there are positions that he could have filled?
I would say no. But what we did present via that labor market survey shows that there was work available. The board didn't hang their hat on that labor market survey. And if you look at page 5 of the board decision, and I know part of the reason we're here is that the decision really wasn't artfully written. It could have been written better. But the factors that I listed in my supplemental brief that the Delaware courts have addressed over time, even though it's not codified, even though we don't have a piece of paper saying these are the factors the board must look at when determining reasonableness of a job search, the 8 factors that I gleaned from the case law...
Tell me what's on page 5 of the decision.
All of the factors the board addressed. It wasn't addressed in their case analysis, but they obviously pulled these pieces of information out of the hearing. The timing of the job search, the number of jobs Mr. Watson looked at, his motive, the fact that he informed his employers or potential employers of his restrictions. Did he keep a list of the people he contacted? He did, but he couldn't testify that he did any follow-up, that he knew about the jobs, that he inquired about the educational requirements. The board went through all of this analysis and the evidence, but didn't quite make that sound so nice in the conclusion part.
Are you saying that no reasonable person on these facts could have concluded that he didn't make a reasonable job search?
I think the board's decision was correct. It was not reasonable.
On what basis?
On the basis of their analysis of those factors. It's not the labor market survey report that tipped the balance. That's used after this initial analysis is done. What did the claimant do? Let's look at what he did or didn't do. And the board did that.
So there are at least two separate issues that are floating around here. One is, was the employee a displaced worker? And the second is, as a displaced worker, did the employee make a reasonable job search? Is that a fair...
Well...
This is a predicate to the real question I have, which is this. Is the relevance, the legal relevance of the survey, simply to establish by way of rebuttal that the employee is not totally disabled?
Yes.
But is not relevant to whether or not there was a reasonable search? Or is it relevant, and is it fair to say that in your side's view, the survey does double duty? That is, it can be used to disprove reasonable search and disprove displaced worker status.
I think it may do double duty in certain situations, especially when you have a claimant that comes in who doesn't even go near the jobs identified in the survey. Once the employer has the opportunity to put that in front of the board...
I thought the facts in this case indicate that he did apply to several of the jobs on the
list. I'm talking about a different case. So.
All right, well, so what you're saying is that the law is and should be that a displaced worker has to prove that he truly can't find a job, and that the employer can rebut that presumption by showing that there are hypothetical jobs available.
That is how our system works.
Now, let's assume hypothetically that this court decides that there was a reasonable job search and that the burden shifted back to the employer. What should happen?
The injured worker in this case did not raise on appeal the any sort of deficiency related to the presentation of evidence related to the labor market survey report. If this court determines that there was a reasonable job search or that Mr. Watson deserved the inference that there was no work because of his restrictions, I'm not saying that that's how it should come out, but if that happens, the burden has shifted. The burden shifted down below, and we presented proper evidence to show that he is employable, that he has transferable skills in the education and the professional background to be employed, and that he does have a loss of earning capacity. So in a sense, if the court decides that the reasonableness decision, I'm sorry I'm out of time, but the reasonableness decision by the board was an error, it doesn't change the outcome of the case.
But the board did not address the particular circumstances of the applications to the same employers that were in the labor market survey and the failure to be employed by basically applying to the sum of the employers that your client is saying are available as employers.
I think they weighted in the balance in the big picture.
Well, we're guessing at that, aren't we?
I'd have to read the decision again, but...
All right.
Thank you.
In terms of if the board finds that there's a reasonable job search, I think that ends the case. If there's a reasonable job search and there's no job, then the person continues to be totally disabled. I mean, that's the weighing of the job search versus
the... Well, what happens to the employer? What if the employer says there's a reasonable job search, but we can carry our burden that is shifted to us?
I think the employer loses. I mean, I think that's part of the weighing that the Industrial Accident Board does, is here's your labor market survey, there are jobs out there, and then the employee says, well, I applied for 6 of those 9 jobs you identified, and no one called me back, no one hired me, no one even gave me a second look.
Let me get some further information. Let's assume for the moment that upon establishing that one has made a reasonable job search, that, as you say, that does it. That establishes that the person is a displaced worker. Should the employer be burdened with having to pay those full benefits indefinitely? Does the system provide, say, 6 months later, the employer can come back in and say, okay, the job market has gotten better? And let's see what you've been looking for in the last 6 months, even though you showed that you couldn't find a job the last time we were here? Or is it pretty much, that's it, you're now, you can put your feet up and not work?
The system is not set up so that you can just put your feet up. Insurance companies, employers routinely file petitions to terminate based on changed circumstances. Either you've gotten better, or we think you now can go find a job. There's no restriction on the...
And there's no restriction on the time within which you can do that?
No.
So 6 months later, 3 months later, you know, all of a sudden a new plant opens in the area where this person lives, and they're looking for work,
right?
Workers. So the employer could then file a new petition and say, this person is no longer a displaced worker.
Correct. The employers actually do that routinely. They send people back for additional DMEs, defense medical exams, to see if the person's gotten better.
But there is some time limitation, isn't there? They can't come back 10 days after the initial proceedings are over and start this thing over again.
Now, I've certainly never seen that, but I don't know that there's a statutory or a rule that says they can't do that. They also have an economic decision to make. I mean, these labor market surveys are not inexpensive. They're $5,000 to $7,000. When you account the survey itself and then the testimony. So they make an economic decision, but routinely they come back. Very few people just get total disability for the rest of their lives without pushback from the employers. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and also take a short recess.
Thank you.